Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name is Michael Johnston, and this is an episode on New Books in Sociology, a channel on New Books Network. Today I have Dr. Stephen Ortiz, an associate professor of sociology at Oregon State University. Thank you for joining me today, Steve.
Well, it's great to be with you.
Excellent. So, Steve, could you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Well, I've been at Oregon State University since 2000, where I teach courses in social psychology, sports, collective behavior, and intimate relationships, and from time to time, a course called Sociology of the Sport Marriage.
Excellent. The book that we're discussing today is The Sport Marriage, Women Who Make It Work, a book published by University of Illinois Press. Could you tell me a little bit how you came to write this book?
Well, during my initial investigation of my interest in family sociology and sports sociology and professional athletes, I noticed that there was a knowledge gap regarding the wives and families of professional athletes. And I was really surprised at the lack of knowledge about the heteronormative sport marriage, especially given the widespread popularity of professional athletes in sports. So I decided that here was a story that needed to be told.
So as I was reading through your book, I noticed that there was a bit of a difference between the experience that a wife would have if she were married to a rookie or to a veteran. How did those experiences differentiate from one another?
Well, it's interesting because both rookies and veterans reflect the kind of marriage that they're in. That the kind of marriage that they're in is an equalizer to an extent. So, for example, in my first study, I came across bits and pieces of information that I put together and called the career-dominated marriage. And in a career-dominated marriage, a husband and his career come first, and his wife and family are subordinate to both, whether or not the wife has a job or a career of her own. So in this kind of marriage, they become aware of an unwritten rule book and what's in it. So this unwritten rule book is about learning the do's and don'ts of being married to a professional athlete. For example, in chapter 2, it's avoiding doing anything in public life that would reflect negatively on the husband or his team. In chapter 3, I describe different rules that the wives must follow while traveling with their husbands and teams. I refer to this as a code of conduct. In chapter 6, I talk about groupies and the rules that the wives have to follow when dealing with groupies in public life. So this type of marriage is often embedded in other male-dominated occupations besides professional sport. So this would include law enforcement, politics, entertainment, medicine, religion, military, and so on and so forth. In male-dominated occupations, most women are relegated to subordinate status, whether they are wives, unmarried female partners, or co-workers. And in certain cases, because of this workaholic approach that he takes, this arrangement might result in the husband's neglect of his marriage and family as he builds and focuses only on his career. So the husband who would take advantage of this career-dominated situation is the spoiled athlete. The player with the spoiled athlete syndrome, as I call it, learns to control others by influencing or pressuring or manipulating them to accept his needs or wishes. Other characteristics include, for example, he may have a deep sense of male entitlement, a strong perception of occupational power, a lack of accountability for inappropriate off-the-field activities, and a diminished sense of responsibility for marital and family functioning. The spoiled athlete believes that the world revolves around him. So there's some narcissism involved. If he's famous, the spoiled athlete will embrace his celebrity status and most likely will try to use it to his advantage or to take advantage of others. And finally, mood changes, emotional outbursts, rash judgment, emotional or verbal abuse, acts of hostility, and even violent behavior are common among those who have this syndrome. So I examined the career-dominated marriage, the spoiled athlete syndrome, and many other issues in a longitudinal study, a second follow-up study that I did. I found the existence of a career-dominated marriage in six major themes, which are the six chapters in the book. They include public life, traveling with the husband and his team, power and control issues, mother-in-law issues, groupies, and infidelities. I discovered that the sport marriage still flourishes as a career-dominated marriage, and all six chapters are evidence of this.
And you write a little bit about the wife's experience with her social circles as part of the larger professional family. How does this fall into the equation in terms of their relationship with other sports wives, whether they be married to the professional athlete or they be a girlfriend of that athlete?
Social circles serve as a way of connecting with each other. It's who they hang out with. It's all about their friendships. So the wife feels accepted by other wives in her social circle. And it's in circles, in these social circles, that wives support one another. They share stressors, pressures, and setbacks in the husband's career. And so they feel from time to time that outsiders can't relate to them. And they have trouble relating to outsiders who know nothing about their husband's careers. So she tends to have more in common with certain wives than others. For example, she might be a member of a Bible study group. They might be going through pregnancy together. They have a shared interest in certain activities. So you have the wives as members of the social circle. But to answer your question, the girlfriends are part of it and they're not part of it. The girlfriends are rated by the wives according to the type of relationship they have with the players. They range from the revolving door girlfriend, the steady girlfriend, the cohabitating girlfriend, and the fiance. So the first three come and go, and they could never count on seeing a wife who was a steady girlfriend, or, you know, cohabitating girlfriend or revolving door girlfriend. They can't see these girlfriends as anything to have to do with them. So the fiance is closer to becoming one of them. And so she is more acceptable than the other three girlfriends.
in this girlfriend experience, is there an experience that changes as the relationship starts to grow between the two, between the professional athlete and her, or is the girlfriend never able to be fully established into the larger social circle of professional athlete and the wives?
That's a good question. The revolving door girlfriend, the steady girlfriend, and the cohabitating girlfriend are, shall we say, non-existent. They only accept them if the professional athlete accepts them and brings them to different functions, team functions, social functions. But they will still keep a distance. They won't embrace them because they don't know how long they're going to be around. The fiancé has a better shot at being accepted outright because she is going to be one of them eventually. So she may be more acceptable.
And there's also something to say about the professional athlete, if I recall, about whether or not the wife is accepted, depending on whether the athlete is a rookie or a full-time professional athlete who has experience in the league. Is that correct?
Yes. I found that rookie wives, let's say the rookie players don't have much social or cultural capital because they haven't proven themselves. So their status is limited. It's tenuous, and it tends to be very low. And their wives share this status. Nobody really knows how long they're going to be around or if they're going to be around at all. Generally, they'll know after the first season and whether or not he's on the team and he's one of them, which means his wife is one of them, or whether he's gone altogether.
And what are some of the unwritten rules then that the rookies' wives have that, as part of this waiting period as they figure out whether or not that player is going to be a good fit for that team?
Well, for the rookie players, it's know your place. They have to know their place, and their place is conveyed in the locker room, during practice, team functions, and in other ways where they interact with each other. For the wives, it's also knowing your place. And this happens through bridal showers, baby showers, at home games they sit together, and so on. So the message is very clear. Don't do anything to rock the boat. Just bide your time. And if your husband is acceptable and he makes the team, then you will be too.
Now, this doesn't completely relieve the veteran player, nor does it relieve the veteran player's wife of challenges of their own.
Yeah.
So what are some of the challenges that wives of veteran players experience, as well as the experience that veteran players are having being in the league for many years?
Well, the starting point has to do with the career-dominated marriage. It's the career-dominated model that is at the center of the marriage. And the wives find that they have to be strong and resilient to make it work. But this strength and resolve sometimes isn't enough. In trying to support this type of marriage, it leaves the wife feeling empty and unfulfilled, especially if she has to give up an aspiration that means a lot to her in favor of his career. For example, in the introduction, I talk about Dana's attempt to take her own life because she had to give up everything that she valued and she thought it would come back to her. It was just a temporary thing. But after a number of years into the marriage, she realized that she's always going to be a baseball wife, and that's pretty much going to be it. So she saw no alternative to her situation and tried to take her life. But there are other challenges that the wives have to cope with, and the stressors in the husband's career and in their marriage. And these would include, for example, geographic mobility and instability, seasonal separations, occupational injuries, The groupies, infidelities, public life, traveling on the road with her husband, and power and control issues in the marriage. There's a story about Amanda where she had an eating disorder, and she found out later it's bulimia. And she had this at a relatively young age, and she dealt with it the best way possible. It progressed from laxatives to binging, purging. And she thought her husband-to-be, they met in college, he played college football, that he would be sensitive to her issue. And when he found out, he discovered her late at night when she was eating, unbeknownst to him, and gorging herself. And he discovered her at night, in the middle of the night. And so he wanted to know what was going on. And so she told him. And he seemed to be supportive and sensitive and said, yes, I understand. Okay. And then when they went out and were around people, and he would make fun of her. He would say she's got an eating disorder that ends all eating disorders, and he just made a joke out of it. And she found out that he wasn't very supportive and he wasn't sensitive. And this was something that she had to deal with if she was going to stay with him, is to be the butt of his jokes. So, yeah.
You're right a little bit about how some of the women would remain employed, but it was difficult for them because even if they have their own career, their husband's career still served as primary. And then other issues that that came up were with childcare and the necessity for the mother to be a full-time mom while being a full-time wife. Could you talk a little bit more about those challenges?
Well, yeah, the career-dominated model is one way of looking at it. But the two-person career that I've used by another sociologist gets at the idea that the wife provides support in various ways. She provides support without recognition of what she does for his career. She provides economic, the fact that she doesn't have to go out and work so she can do everything in the home. That gets at what you were saying. It's a way of supporting his career. So in a way, she's in service to his career. And she does this without taking pay or any recognition, formal recognition. So it's a situation where she feels that her main duty is her family, but supporting his career is part of that responsibility. So she will give him rubdowns after games. She will time his wind sprints during the off season. She will make his favorite dishes and meals, but that are healthy. She oversees his rehabbing if he's injured seriously. There was a wife who... her husband had a hip injury. He played football. And she said, here's a little bell and just ring it whenever you need me. And so he was okay for a few days, but boy, he gave in to the urge because he kept ringing that bell incessantly. And she said, well, I'm going to take it away from you. I'm tired of you ringing this dang bell and you're driving me crazy and on and on and on. So he got the message. They do everything they can to make sure that he plays well, that he has a successful career. But what's interesting about it is that I found that a wife will expect him to be good at what he does, to have career success. It's an expectation that she values. She's saying, look, I'm doing all this for you. I'm making it possible for you to be out on the field. I take care of all your needs. And that's fine. I accept that responsibility. But you, on the other hand, have to be a success. You have to make it worth my while. So doing this for him validates her sense of self-esteem. It makes her feel good about herself. But she feels even better if he's successful in his career. Then it's a validation of what she does for him.
And then the overall experience, even after the career is over with, really depends on whether that athlete continues their career in a highly competitive market. What influence? So maybe it's less about sport, but maybe more about competition. Did you find that as being a major influence in how the marriage is, how it exists?
Well, there is a term that I use that I call the internalized we partnership. And the wife does all of this marital labor, we'll call it, and she internalizes. She feels good about what she's doing as long as he's successful. Now, part of this internalized we partnership is a vicarious identification with his success. She feels good about herself if he has a good game, if he gets him into the World Series. It comes back to her. Oh, you must feel so proud of him. The owner might say, you girls are doing a good job at home. Keep it up. So there's that going on. And there's another thing that I refer to as teamwork, a marital teamwork. So the wife sees what she does for her husband as a kind of teamwork. She does her share of the work. He does his share of the work, which is to be successful. So she, this teamwork, though, backfires, will often backfire because he will take advantage of it. And she begins to realize that she is doing more of the giving and he's doing more of the taking. And she gives and gives and gives, and he keeps taking and taking and taking.
Yes, that makes sense. And outside of the marriage, there's also a brotherhood that exists among the players. And this brotherhood that exists, how is that institutionalized within professional sports? Is that relationship also a key part of being an athlete at the professional level?
Well, yeah. I think going back to the other question, you were referring to retirement. Does this pattern, the career-dominated pattern, does this stand up over time? I would say yes. I just finished an article where I write about the retirement issues. And this career-dominated marriage can continue to exist if he finds a job, a career, that sustains a career-dominated model, like law enforcement or firefighters, where the marriage continues to be important, but not to the extent that his career is, his new career, his second or third career. Most of the baseball wives, I found out in the second study, their husbands went into coaching, right into coaching. So they have that competitive thing going on. And the wives feel that they had no idea they would go on, that their husbands would go on to coach. And so they throw up their hands and say, well, here we go again, you know? So it tends to define what they do as work, not only in retirement, but as a second career, it continues well into the later years. The brotherhood. Sport organizations isolate players from the public, and they strictly control the men's schedules and activities and encourage them to strongly bond with each other. So certain patterns become embedded, which distinguish them as a special group of men who have a strong sense of superiority and that they are separate from non-athletes. This brotherhood emphasizes strong support. It emphasizes mutual respect It emphasizes feelings of solidarity, and it emphasizes an inherent loyalty. And among this brotherhood of teammates, they are governed by certain team rules. And these team rules support and enforce group boundaries and exclude most outsiders. So teammates, in collectively managing boundaries of their solidarity and their loyalty to each other, well, they are led to exclude women as part of this brotherhood. Women such as wives from various areas of their occupations. So the women are finding that they are privy to certain information about the players, and they don't want this kind of information. So it works both ways. They guard clubhouse and locker room secrets. The men in this brotherhood protect sexual privilege with male groupies, with female groupies, and with other interested women. And so it's an interesting story. I call it Team Spirit Night. Every Thursday night during the season, they have a Team Spirit Night. And this is where the team rules are enforced. And the wives are aware of what's going on. Because basically what's going on is the team meets at different clubs or bars, and they meet other women at these bars or clubs. And so the wives aren't allowed to go on these excursions. It's just the men. And it's where they hook up with some of the women that they meet. So on this one Team Spirit Night, this rookie brought his wife to one of the bars. And the men didn't know what to make of it. They were surprised that he would have brought his wife. And so they carried on like they normally would without women around. And he got the hint that she shouldn't be there. So he left early that evening. And the very next day, he had a sign on his locker saying, "You owe us $600 for this rule infraction." And so he was caught off guard, and he didn't realize that they were, well, that the rules were that important. And he found out that they were. So how do the wives feel about this brotherhood? They don't like it. Many wives feel that they are in direct competition with the brotherhood. They feel that they spend too much time together. They've already spent a lot of time together, time that could be spent with their families.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And there's also a culture of infidelity that exists with this brotherhood. I think one of the stories that you told in the book was about the slump buster and the role that that plays in Major League Baseball, but I'm sure that the slump buster also exists in other sports. Could you talk more about the slump buster, but also about infidelity at large in professional sports?
Okay. The code work that these wives engage in, or this code of conduct, there is a set of rules that are stipulated by the husbands as part of, by the players, really in general, that they're supposed to follow, that if wives travel with the team, they have to follow these rules. And so the rules revolve around what you see on the road is what you don't repeat when you off the road. And the wives follow the rules, for example, where they're supposed to sit on the plane or the bus. They sit at the front where the men sit at the back. But probably the most irritating rule for the wives is about going into the hotel bars. And the hotel bars are off limits to the wives. And I thought, well, when I was first told this, I thought, well, that's where the men hang out and they do some male bonding and they talk about the finer points of the game. And the wives would interrupt me and say, oh, no, that's not what they're doing. That's where they meet their girlfriends or their women on the road or call girls or groupies. And they don't want their wives to see that they're interacting with these women. So the hotel bar where the team stays, right, is off limits. So the wives told me how they would get off the elevator, come down to the street level, and avert, look away from the hotel bar and look straight at getting outside. And the worst thing you could do is walk in there and hang out. So that's one of the rules. Now, a code buster is somebody who violates the rules knowingly. He does this because he can. When he, for example, there was one famous baseball player, and he said, what are you girls doing out here? And he said, well, we are not supposed to go in the bar area. And he said, follow me, come with me. This is a ridiculous rule. So he walks in there and he takes them in there and they're seated and they order their drinks and the men are looking at him. But he could get away with it because he was famous and he was a star on the team. And the wives kept looking over their shoulders. They were saying things like, we shouldn't be here. This is not cool. And they were uneasy the whole time. But he, said, have a seat and do what you want to do, and nobody will bother you.
And the infidelity was quite interesting in terms of what you found. One of the women you wrote about was on her way up the elevator with her husband and was approached by one of the other groupies. And in that experience, the groupie thought that she was just another one of them. That being said, what's this virgin prostitute syndrome that the wives are expected to play in their marriage?
Well, let's go back. The example that you gave is it's close, but it's not quite accurate. And this goes back to the do's and don'ts of traveling on the road. So this wife, after the game, this wife was going back to her hotel. And so she was taking the elevator to go up to her hotel room. And when the doors opened, there was a player and a woman who was not his wife. So she didn't know whether to get on the elevator or step back and let it go without her. So she said, so she thought to herself, well, this is dumb. This is ridiculous. So she got on the elevator, but she looked away from the couple. So she was looking at the corner of the top of the elevator, just trying to disappear in a way. And so she got off at her floor and she went to her room. Well, the next day, the husband was confronted by this player, and he wanted to know if he was going to keep his, if his wife was going to keep her mouth shut. So one of the rules on the road is when you witness inappropriate behavior, or what I call forbidden behavior, like the elevator story, they're supposed to keep quiet about it. And one wife, I'll never forget, she had enough of it. She said she took him up to the room and she started yelling at him. This is ridiculous. I don't want to be a part of this. And so he told her, you know, this is something that, you know, she has to do if he, if she has any value for his career. So the culture of adultery, culture of infidelity, it's a persistent, the persistent presence of these women, these female groupies and other sexually available women who converge to set the stage for players to be guided by and to participate in a culture that perpetuates and normalizes marital infidelity. This culture would not exist if the institutionalized brotherhood didn't sanction teammates who individually or collectively take advantage of sexual opportunities for women. So according to the wives, the culture of infidelity exists because of the assertive actions of women. They also maintain that the players share the blame because they condone and encourage the presence of these women. So in this culture, most women are considered partners to unfaithful husbands. They are considered prospective partners to unfaithful husbands because of the way that male infidelity has become so institutionalized. For example, Emma was, after a game, her husband played baseball, and after a game, she was asked by her husband to go out to meet another player on the team. So she was delighted because she assumed that the other player was going to bring his wife. And she knew this man and she knew his wife. So she said, so she assumed that was going to be the case. And she looked forward to it. And after the game, she was all dressed up and everything, and they were going to go out. And so they went over to a high-end restaurant and were seated. And here comes the other friend, his friend, and he's bringing along a woman who is not his wife. And she, Emma, just blew it. She said, I'll be darned if I'm going to sit here through dinner and act friendly toward this woman. And, you know, what do I do? Do I tell the wife what her husband's doing? You know, she was all in turmoil with conflicted feelings about the situation. And her husband looked at her like, you know, just go along with it. She's just, it's just a friendly thing. And no problem, no problem. So this buddy system, as I call it, is part of being in this brotherhood. And it is extended to include husbands who are unfaithful and is part of this culture of adultery. So how does this come about when we talk about the motherization of the wife and the virgin prostitute syndrome? Well, let's talk about the motherization of the wife first. First of all, the wife is relegated to the role of mother in their relationship. Motherization begins early in the relationship before the couple even marries. And he becomes dependent on her, which would be his fiancée, to take care of many domestic and occupational details. Now, this is a prelude to marriage. And how well she's able to accomplish these things is something that he would take note of. The wife, later on, happily fulfills this role in the beginning of the marriage, but can feel trapped by it later on. Motherization secures a husband's power in the smart marriage, because in this role, she is subordinate to him. Many wives are fairly comfortable in this maternal role, and this may be rooted in their early childhood experiences, or they simply find it's easier to be a mother to their husbands because it avoids unnecessary conflict and arguing and fighting and helps to preserve stability in the marriage by providing some aspect of continuity in their seasonal lives. So why fight it? This is especially true when the husband is on the road most of the time. Motherization limits a wife's ability to relate to her husband as a whole person. So the player's wife acts as a mother to her husband when he needs emotional or esteem support, or when he suffers a crucial setback in his career, such as when he's unexpectedly traded to another team, or he loses his position in the starting lineup, or he experiences a serious career-threatening injury. Most wives will support their husbands in these and other occupational situations, regardless of whether they have been motherized. But the motherized wife slips into this role because it has already been defined and realized as an essential aspect of the marriage, and because she believes, above all else, that it benefits his career and their marriage. Now, what's interesting is that what the wife told me is that the husband will look for this quality in a woman and realizes that he can marry almost any woman who is attracted to a professional athlete. But the woman he marries will have this quality, and this is a quality that he is actively looking for. Once this pattern is established in the marriage, a woman's deference to her husband and his career can become habit-forming, and it plays a very important part in the husband's dependency on his wife. Now, do the wives do this to themselves? No. The husbands see them this way. Do the wives go along with it? Because it's better than trying to fight it. What is the virgin prostitute syndrome? According to the wives, these men tend to make a very sharp distinction between sex and love, or they emphasize sex in their expressions of love, an attitude that can indicate a good girl, bad girl duality in their notions of femininity. The good girl is passive. She's conservative. She's a pedestaled virgin. She is loved and protected, and above all else, she is desexualized. The bad girl is the mysterious seductress. She is objectified, targeted for promiscuity, possibly feared, and sexualized or hypersexualized. I refer to this attitude as the virgin prostitute syndrome and see it as another pattern in the motherization of the wife. A player who expresses the virgin prostitute syndrome believes that his role is to be protector and sole provider for his wife and family. He expects his wife to act in ways that make her worthy of his protection, that make her worthy of financial security, to make her worthy of material comfort. He views his wife as the good girl, and in certain situations, he may attempt to virginize her by de-emphasizing sex in their marriage. As an outlet for sexual energy he must withhold from his wife, he seeks out the bad girl, such as an eager female groupie. A player who motherizes his wife might make a sharp distinction between the wife who is at home caring for the children, on the one hand, and on the other hand, all other women, which would include female groupies and sex workers who are sexually available. Now, this attitude points to the belief that motherhood and sexual female sexuality is essentially different and perhaps even incompatible. A husband may not always be comfortable with his wife's sexuality, and so he attempts to desexualize her. The women told me that expressions of the syndrome are more noticeable when their husbands have been on the road for a long time. When a player returns home from a long road trip and his wife is delighted to see him, she may attempt to initiate a romantic encounter or sexual interaction. If he has motherized her, he may become confused and discourage or refuse her advances. He may say that he's too tired, that it's been a very long road trip, that instead he would prefer to relax and have a good home-cooked meal. Rhonda had an experience with her husband that underlines this duality. She told him that they were going to have friends, they were going to have dinner with friends at a high-end hotel. And so she got a babysitter for the children, and they went off to have dinner. And she they were waiting for their friends to show up, and they never did, so they went ahead and had dinner. And midway through dinner, she excused herself, and she went and met with the hotel staff. And she said, give him this note and this card, this key card, and, about 15 minutes after I, go up there. So she took off and went up to the suite, and one of the people there, staff, came over and gave him this message. And he said, well, what the heck? What's going on? Why meet her in a room? So he goes, oh, well, okay, I'll go. So he went up there, and he didn't know what was going on. And so he opened the door, and he saw her in negligee, lingerie. The lights were dimmed. There was soft music on. And she was trying to grow to arrange for a romantic rendezvous because at that point in her marriage, romance was gone, and she had to plan on it. She had to work on it and schedule it. And so here he stood in front of her, and he said, oh, my God. And he said, what the heck are you doing? And he got mad. He got so angry, he turned around and he walked down. And she let him have it when they were at home later on. And she told him, you're never romantic. We don't have romantic evenings. We don't have date nights. We don't have anything. The romance is gone. And I try to inject a little bit of romance. And all I get for my trouble is I'm scolded. I'm yelled at. And I'm angry at you for this. So the question, is it possible for a wife to play a combination of a good girl and bad girl? Yes, it is, but it depends on the situation.
I think there might be some role boundaries that have been created as a result of the unwritten rules of an athlete and the expectation that he holds of his wife playing the mother role that could result in some of these conflicts that are occurring with the players and their wives throughout this book.
Well, in this case, in Rhonda's case, she wanted him to be more romantic. But how can you be romantic with your mother?
It makes it difficult and to uphold both roles.
Well, this is why in most cases the men are limited in terms of romance, and they don't make the effort to show their wife how much they feel for them, how much they love them. And this again gets back to the idea that here I sacrifice for him. I support him. I do everything I can for him. And the least he can do is be romantic, if not to have career success as the end result. So at least he can be romantic with me when I want to and have some romance. And he can't even do that.
So, what are some takeaways? Where do you see this research continuing in its trajectory? It was a lot to take in. Definitely, it was an interesting study. I guess what do you see for the future of this research and where it's going next?
Well, I wanted to add something first, if I may.
Okay.
Yes. I may have stereotyped these women initially, but I was so surprised. I found these women to be strong, resilient, intelligent, and devoted. And they see so many things in their marriage as normal. The stressors, the pressures, the demands, the setbacks. They see these as normal. And they have normalized what many would consider to be abnormal marriages. So they don't know anything differently than these particular ways that they have of normalizing what many think is quite strange and bizarre. That's why they don't reach out to people. They stay within themselves because people will only criticize them and say, well, I wish my husband was making $3 million, $4 million a year. I wish that you have it so good. You can belong to country clubs. You can have nannies for your children. You can send your children to the best school. I wish I was you, you know? So don't say anything that would be critical about your marriage because anybody would be happy to step in. So I have a paper that's been accepted for publication by the Sociology of Sport Journal, and it's Women Caring for Retired Men, Continuation of Inequality in the Sport Marriage. To answer your question, I've started work on a second book, a sequel, and it's going to cover geographic mobility, different kinds of stressors, seasonal separations, occupational injuries, and retirement issues. And that's going to keep me busy.
Yes. Always more work to do. And this book is excellent, and it's going to, I hope for it to have a great impact in society. You're disseminating this information, I think, as a in hopes that people will learn something from it, but also be able to possibly apply it into practice. Everything from diversity issues to having managers or part of the corporate office, having people there to help the players work through marital issues that might be taking place.
Can I say something?
Yes.
The conclusion of the book has advice for women considering marriage to a professional athlete. And I got most of this from the second book, the second study that I did, and it's pretty detailed. So any woman thinking about marrying a professional athlete, if nothing else, if they go to the conclusion, they'll get a real good, realistic viewpoint of what it's like to be married to an athlete.
This second book, or this book project that you're working on now with retirement, that's that's probably moving a little bit away from marital issues and more towards players and what to expect after the game. Is that correct?
Yes. I found that multiple concussions, CTE, is a major issue. And the wives talked about that. They talked about depression and how devastating depression is and how it affects their moods, their mood swings. So the physical injuries, the mental, emotional injuries, so to speak, and the wives aren't prepared for it. I liken it to a woman in her 20s, and she doesn't know what lies ahead if she is able to sustain this marriage. And after his career is over, they are the primary caregivers. They have to provide care work to their husbands, because even though they were used to it during his career, and retirement is difficult because they are deteriorating in terms of their bodies and minds. And these brittle bodies and broken minds, the wives have no idea of how to care for them. So they're considering institutionalization, and they hate to do that because they've been married for 20, 25 years. And he's not the same man that she married.
Well, thank you for the sneak peek on this upcoming project. And I look forward to reading it once it's been published and possibly having you back on the show for another episode.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to discuss my book.
Thank you all for listening. This has been another episode of New Books in Sociology. Again, it's a channel on the New Books Network. And have a great day.